This episode of Warp 5 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints, featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
Hi, I'm Anthony Montgomery, Ensign Travis Mayweather on Star Trek Enterprise, and you're listening to Trek FM.
How we doing, Trip?
Ready when you are.
Prepare for warp.
Course laid in, sir. Request permission to get underway.
Let's go.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Warp 5, our dedicated Enterprise show. I'm Christopher Jones, and Kate is under the weather this week, so instead, I'm joined by someone else with a cute accent. A voice that is very familiar to listeners on the network, none other than the Supreme Commander of Trek FM Europe, Colin Higgins. Hey, Colin, thanks for joining me today.
I like that introduction. Yes, I've been through Decon. I've got the cream on. I'm ready to go.
You know, people always comment on Kate having a cute accent, so I figure, well, they're going to love yours too. It's different, but it's cute, right? Yeah.
The English accent's the best.
That's right. Now, I have another question for you, Colin. As Supreme Commander, that's a really fancy title. As Supreme Commander, do you get to design your own belt buckle?
I do indeed, yes. And it's got lights that move across the middle of it and they go up and down. And I wear it with my Star Trek t-shirt that lights up as well. So I'm fully illuminated in all situations.
Excellent, excellent. And of course, you get big shoulder pads as well. So you've got the whole outfit going there.
I see.
All right. Well, it's great to have you with me this week because as some of our listeners may not know, because we have a lot of listeners to this show who don't necessarily listen to other shows in the network. Outside
Shame
of Warp 5, yeah, you got to listen to the other shows, people. But outside of Warp 5, I think you're responsible for the majority of the Enterprise coverage that we have on the network.
Yeah. Trek News and Views did extensive Enterprise coverage.
Yeah, we get to it every 5 weeks on the Ready Room because we do that rotation. But yeah, you did it quite more often there on TNV.
About every third week.
So big Enterprise fan, no doubt. Yeah. Well, this is a little change for me too because we normally record in the afternoon and tonight we're recording at night. And it's nice because I've got myself a nice glass of Avian brandy of the Zindi variety here in my hand tonight. And it's from one of the last bottles known to exist in the whole galaxy.
Wow. See, now this is the shoes on either side of the foot now, because last time I did the Red Room, I could drink and you couldn't. And now because it's your evening, you can drink and I can't because I've got to drive my car again in a bit. So
that's right. Because normally when we record, for you, it's like when you're on the Ready Room, it's like 2 a.m. But you've got a big pint in your hand, even though it's the middle of the night.
Yeah, well, you know, you gotta lubricate the throat, keep the vocal cords wet.
Right, right. That's so exactly.
What better than get the Steiner out and fill the Steiner up?
It's the best way to do it, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, Colin, my Avian brandy here, it leads us into our topic for tonight, which is the Zindi. And of course, we're going to touch on the six different species, but more specifically, we'll discuss the idea of all these different sentient species evolving on one planet, because it's something that we don't really get an explanation for it, at least not in terms of biology and, you know, like a scientific explanation. It's a really interesting idea. I don't know how realistic it is, but what are your initial thoughts on the Zindi? Give everyone a quick overview of the Zindi.
Well, I particularly thought that the inception of the Zindi as a race was a brilliant idea. Because all too often we know that most civilizations in Star Trek is there's a dominant society, which is normally humanoid. which was explained away with the preservers. But with the unique aspect of the Zindi is you've got reptilians, you've got insectoids, you've got aquatics, and well, we are told that they all evolved on the same planet.
A planet called Zindus, which I really want to be a valid word and word with friends.
Yes. Yeah, I keep putting Star Trek words into word with friends and it keeps saying word not valid.
I know. It takes a few.
I'm very disappointed on you. I mean, you know, can't even put Gak in.
I know. I should take that. But yeah, so all evolving on this one planet.
Yeah, and it's you know, the evolutionary aspects. I mean, if you take Earth as a prime example, we know there was other versions of Homo sapien. Current speculation is there was around 7 to 8 different versions, and we're just the one that prevailed.
Yeah, but that's an interesting point, and when we get to where we talk about unique evolution, we'll delve more into that. But that's a good point about here on Earth. Yet these Zindi are further apart in terms of what type of animals they evolved from to develop sentience. So it is really quite interesting. But so yeah, we have these, and then we have the
There's the arboreals, the insectoids, the primates, the reptilians, the aquatics, the avians.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, the avians are extinct by the time we see the Zindi in Enterprise. So we just kind of hear that they once existed, but we don't know much else about them. So, well, why don't we move into, I call these guys the 6 flavors of Zindi rather than the 6 species of Zindi. And the reason
I'm not eating reptilian ice cream.
Right. It's Baskin Robbins. The Zindi flavor of the month is reptilian. It's green. But the thing is, so in a technical sense, and again, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a biologist, so, you know, I'm sure I will make mistakes in discussing this topic tonight in terms of, you know, anyone who's listening who is a scientist, they'll probably be screaming at the...
Yeah, any evolutionary scientist or biologist or anthropologist listening will be emailing.
Well, I'm sure my friend Athena, who wrote the Athena Andreatis, who wrote the biology of Star Trek, will probably be sending me some messages about all the mistakes I make here. Yeah. But
before we start, Athena, it's not my fault. Okay,
that's right. So, in a technical sense, the species are they're organisms that are capable of interbreeding with one another to produce fertile offspring. Right. So, you get a horse and a donkey, and they mate and they produce a mule, but a mule's infertile. So, so these are actually different species. So we don't know if the Zindi can mate with one another or not. You know, I mean, I don't imagine that the insectoids can mate with the aquatics, but maybe the primates and the arboreals can interbreed. You know, we don't know, but so it feels a little weird to use the term species for them because they don't necessarily qualify under this technical definition, but then you can, you know, talk about traits like DNA similarity. And then in that sense, maybe they do, because that's sort of the idea behind it. So that's why I call them 6 flavors. But let's talk about the arboreals first. These guys, to me, certainly seem like the most passive, the pacifists of the group, right?
Yeah, they are definitely the manana species. They are so laid back and so willing and open to ideas and stuff compared to some of the other species like the insectoids and reptilians who just want to kill everything.
Right. They remind me of sloths, of course, because they are, you know, they're portrayed as they would have evolved from sloth-like creatures that lived in the trees. They still prefer shelter in the trees, from what I understand. But they're the mammals on the planet, along with the primates and the aquatics, I guess.
Yeah, and if you take the episode, the shipment, the leader of the settlement says he likes to go wandering in the forest. So, and everywhere you looked around that actual complex, there was loads and loads of trees.
Right. I bet he likes to go. You know, we're recording this in December. It's getting close to the holidays. I just picture him in like a Charlie Brown Christmas where he goes out and he has to like find the Christmas tree. He would just be, he would be so at home in that light. I just wonder if he would.
He definitely would be at home in it, yeah.
I just wonder if he'd pick the same sad tree as Charlie Brown does.
Well, the reptilians are cheap. The reptilians would just send out them seekers to find the tree.
Right.
Yeah. We'll just sit here. They can find the tree.
Yeah. So the arboreals are interesting for sure. Then we have the, well, if we want to stay with the mammals, why don't we jump to the primates real quick? Because the primates are like the human analog, right? I guess
part of
the two races that they came up with first were the primates and the reptilians. And then during the break between season two and season three, they fleshed out the rest of the concept of who the Zindi were, because they really didn't quite know who they were going to be. So naturally, there is one flavor, let's go back to our flavor term here, within the Zindi who are analogous to us as humans, so that we can deal with them on a more even level like we do with other races in Star Trek typically. And so we have the primates. What do you think about these guys?
Well, the primates are obviously, like you said, they're the closest to us. And, you know, the primate that we see the most, which is Dagobah, you can definitely see where that when I was thinking of the species up, there was, you want a humanoid species.
Right.
Because from a viewer's point of view, it's easy to relate to a humanoid species. And obviously it's cheaper.
It is cheaper, yeah. Although they certainly didn't spare any expense or effort in making the insectoids, especially season three. Yeah.
This is one of the interesting things about Enterprise as a series, is they literally could not do this series like 15, 20 years ago.
That's the thing, right? Like, you think it was kind of odd when the third season of Enterprise came on. It was kind of odd to see the CGI characters in the show. But if you think about it, I'm sure TNG would have had these types of characters. They might have even had, you know, there was always that desire to have A-Rex. And so in TAS, you have A-Rex. And now every time someone does a comic of TOS, A-Rex is always on the bridge in the comic because they can draw him. So, you know, you have to imagine that TNG probably would have had, maybe not A-Rex, but would have had CGI characters in it at times, if the technology had been at the same level it was for season three of Enterprise.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. And even when you get to the end of TNG's run and the technology is getting better and better, the aliens that you do see are far more believable than what you've seen in season one.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So speaking of insectoids, you know, I can't, and you're talking about having a humanoid for us to play against, I can't picture Archer with an insectoid in a shuttle pod trying to get information out from him, you know, talking about his larvae, you know, what were their names? I just don't see that working. So you need a humanoid. No. You need Degra to be a humanoid.
Yeah. And it was also interesting that they classed the insectoids as a belligerent race.
Yeah.
Because humans as a species are adverse to insects.
Right.
You know, arachnophobia is one of the most common phobias.
Yeah.
But most people, when they see an insect in their house, they kill it.
Yeah.
So it was interesting that I thought that was good that they made them a belligerent race who basically didn't want anything to do with humans at all.
It makes sense, that they would do that. But both the insectoids and the reptilians, two types of animals that we typically have fears of, for sure. The insectoids, though, they were a little bit odd for me in Star Trek, seeing them, just because we had never seen any aliens like that in Star Trek before, to this extent anyway, where you actually have them coming onto the ship, you have them walking down the corridors in the ship. They're like fully fleshed out villains that are CGI, but they are insects. Did it feel odd to you, or was it just a cool addition?
No, I thought it felt like that. I mean, they was completely believable in the interactions when they boarded ships and firefights and stuff like that. It was all completely believable. I think the Achilles heel with insectoids is the 12-year lifespan.
Right.
you know, because basically all you got to do is wait 12 years and they're all dead.
Well, I think maybe Okapa and Insectoid are two races that could have a life together. You know, you've got the 9-year lifespan of the Okapa. You've got the 12-year lifespan of an Insectoid. If they meet at the right time, it could be a beautiful love story.
Yeah. Somehow I can't see Neelix with an Insectoid.
Well, I that might be creepy too, right? You know, some people think the whole Neelix Kes thing is kind of creepy.
Well, Neelix and Kes is definitely creepy, but yeah, Neelix and an Insectoid.
This would be creepy in a different way. I'd feel bad for the Insectoid because Neelix would probably end up trying to cook it. But no, I was...
yeah, with Leola Root.
I was thinking more of a Kes Insectoid relationship where, you know, their age, their lifespans would match up pretty well.
But yeah, they would have a lot of... obviously, they're going to have accelerated growth.
Yeah.
Which is an Insectoid trait. A compass or accelerated growth.
Plus, Okapas have that sack on their back, right? So that'd be the perfect place for the eggs.
For the eggs, yeah. Yeah. They're like a spider. The spider stores the young in an egg sack.
Right. So another interesting thing about the Insectoids is that they have 67 dialects.
Yeah.
And their name, this is interesting too, their names grow longer as they age. So they're like picking up additions. That was also, it sounds odd, but it is kind of a clever addition to Star Trek. It's something that's truly alien. Like, you know, the whole Bajoran last name comes first thing. That's what we do in Japan as well. The last name comes before the given name in Japan. So the Bajoran thing was completely normal to me. This Insectoid thing, though, that's actually something that's alien.
Do you think it's like village elders when they gain titles as they grow older?
Mm-hmm.
It could be something along them lines. So the more distinguished you are, then the more titles you get added to your name.
Right. I think that's probably what it is. And of course, you only have 12 years to distinguish yourself. So that way,
you got to work quick.
That's right. And that way the names don't get too long, but there is that.
God, if they live the same lifespan as us, they'll probably take 3 days just to say, this is, and do the introduction.
Right. Well, the other aggressive species are the reptilians, as we mentioned, and they seem to be like the warriors of the Zindi, right? I mean, the Insectoids get easily annoyed and they'll come after you, but if the Zindi as a whole are in danger, the reptilians are the ones that they're going to send out there.
Yeah, they are definitely the Klingons of the species. And they're all, the interesting thing with the reptilians and the Insectoids there is the fact that they share ships.
Yeah, they have. Well, it's like the Klingons and the Romulans. You know, they shared ships as well.
Yeah, the D7 battlecruiser, yeah. And look how well that worked out.
That's right. But yeah, I guess it's because they're both belligerent that the Insectoids, at least within the group of Zindi, the Insectoids and the reptilians is something they have in common. Maybe they can understand each other a little bit better. And I don't mean by language, I just mean by the way they view the world, the way they view their positions within the society and all. They seem like natural allies with one another as opposed to being allied with the primates or the arboreals.
Yeah, I couldn't really. I mean, the most friction is between the primates and the reptilians.
Naturally,
which was interesting because it's the cold-blooded and the warm-blooded.
Yeah. Well, it's humans and snakes. I mean, we're naturally fearful of snakes, of reptiles. So that made sense for sure. Then we have the aquatics, who I know are your favorite.
Oh, yeah, the aquatics, they make so much sense. Yeah. A water-based species in spaceships. Yeah.
It was kind of odd, right? I mean, I completely get that they would make a water-based sentient species because we practically have one here on Earth with dolphins. I mean, and whales are also intelligent, but you could certainly see dolphins here on Earth having developed sentience, if they're not already sentient. I mean, we really don't know for sure how intelligent dolphins are right now.
No.
So, you know, and give them more time, you know, of evolution, especially if they didn't have the pressures on them that we put on them. Who knows? So I totally get having an aquatic species here when you're going to set up this world where like all the different possibilities actually happened. But in spaceships, yeah, it is kind of it's odd because you see them inside their tanks, inside the spaceships. And that part is just kind of strange. Although it's a good thing that they have the aquatics, because when they're actually building the weapon, they're building it underwater.
Yeah, that's very convenient.
Good place.
What
to
I want
hide
to know
it.
Is when the whale probe comes through, like, you know, this sector of space, why didn't the aquatics go and say hello? Because they would have understood that signal, no problem.
Maybe it's like in Star Trek V, where the alien who's pretending to be God says, you know, like, I'm known by many faces. Maybe the whale probe is like that as well. When it came to Earth, it was looking for humpback whales, but when it went to Zindus, it was looking for aquatics.
Oh, well, there you go then. Problem solved.
All right. So, the aquatics are quite unusual. You know, one thing I like about Enterprise, which I often talk about here on the show, is the way that they portray language and alien languages. And this is kind of bizarre, but I suppose if you think about how communication is handled underwater, which does happen here on Earth, because it is pretty clear, I think, that dolphins and whales both have a complex language, especially dolphins have a complex language.
Yeah, yeah, the clicking sounds
that they use with one another. I actually read something recently where they did a lot of studies, and they feel that they've determined that dolphins actually have unique names for one another within a group, the same way humans do. And that was an interesting discovery, but it doesn't really surprise me.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah. But in terms of language here with the aquatics, it's interesting that they say that when they use the past tense, they switch to sonar.
Yeah. So basically humpback whales are always talking about the past.
Right. I was trying to picture, like, how would that work? So, you know, tenses are really interesting things to me in language anyway, because in Japanese, we don't really have a future tense in the same way that English has a future tense. And so it's interesting when you talk about things and that tense that's analogous to the English one isn't there. And so then I'm picturing, you know, these aquatics, when they switch tenses and they're actually, you know, switching the entire way that they communicate. Quite interesting. So, and then lastly, there's the race that we don't know very much about because we didn't get to see them, the avians.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen a skull and we see pictures, but that's it.
That's it. But there's a story about them, though.
Yeah. They was mentioned in the shipment and the council in the shipment. The sleuths, for want of a better word, tell Archer that they once darkened the skies of Zindus. So, but obviously they weren't the sharpest tools in the box, because when the planet blew up, they went with it.
Right. It is kind of odd, right, that the story is that the avians lacked sufficient technology to get themselves off the planet, which makes me wonder, like, would one of the other races maybe help evacuate them? It also makes me wonder why the story about the Guardians, like, feeding technology to the Zindi so they could develop space travel. And that actually reminded me a little bit of how Vulcans were with humans, right? Because the Guardians are kind of like feeding them information bit by bit, but not just giving them the technology outright. But why are the avians left out of this?
Yeah, the other thing with that is we know there was a 100-year civil war, which is why their planet got destroyed.
Yeah.
And in the Civil War, people form alliances, they make sides. You know, we've established that the insectoids and the reptilians were a faction. You can probably hypothesize that the arboreals and the mammalians were a faction.
Yeah.
So you would think someone would have allied with the avians, given the fact that this is a creature that can fly of its own accord.
Yeah.
That would be a tactical advantage. But no one seemed... that, you know, when the planet was destroyed, no one thought maybe we should take some with us.
Right. It's kind of, you know, kind of odd. It really makes you wish that the history of the Zidni was fleshed out more, right?
Yeah. The only thing I can think of with the Ivan series, they was the ones that rejected the Guardians.
Right. Well, that's the thing, probably. So the Guardians didn't want to give them anything. But still, you would think that as technology is developing around the planet, that if they are also sentient, and apparently, just my reading of it, more or less on the same level, because all these different flavors of Zindi, as I was calling them earlier, they all seem to be sentient on the same level. Like, they're socially and technologically, they are just right on par with one another, which would imply, of course, some exchange of information. You would think that the avians would at least be able to pick that up, even if the Guardians were giving them the cold shoulder.
Yeah, I mean, even if you use Earth now with the internet, something can be invented in Japan, for instance, and then someone in America can log onto the internet and see that invention.
Right, like the robots that I saw fighting on TV tonight.
I'm so gonna change my TV settings.
Yeah, they actually had this. They built robots and then had them fight each other.
Oh, that is cool. Yeah, all we've got is so-called celebrities eating insects in the jungle.
Well, here we'll probably have robots eating insects in the jungle.
Yeah.
Soon, so. But yeah, right. I mean, information spreads very easily is the point. You know, this is actually talking about the Civil War, I think, is a good transition to the major point that we want to talk about, which is it even possible to have a planet like this where you have six distinct species who evolve sentience on a single planet? First of all, that's question number one. Question number two, they evolve sentience and they all evolve at like the same pace, so they're right on par with one another. That's another question. And then another question I have is, supposing this happened, what are the odds? Well, and I guess the fact that there's a civil war sort of answers this question, but what are the odds that they would be able to coexist with one another on the same planet? Because even though they had a civil war, we have wars going on here on Earth all the time, and we really are the same species. You know, we are just one homogenous species with a few, you know, slight variations here and there as you go around the world, and we can't get along. So how would these six species, and well, it is six because the avians they went extinct when Zindus was destroyed itself. So prior to that, six species living on this one world together, getting along well enough that they could continue to evolve to the point where they had space travel. What do you think about that?
Well, the way that I look at it is, if you take two countries as an example, the first one would be Australia, and the second one would be Japan. Now, to take Japan as an example, Japan is a collection of islands that we class as Japan. Mm-hmm. So everyone sees Japan as one thing, but it's really a collection of islands.
Except for China, who class it as part China. But yeah, okay, go on.
Yeah. China classes the world as China.
Right.
So, yeah. And especially when there's gas and oil involved.
Yes.
But but if you then took them islands and you put them on a planetary scale, on a planet the size of Earth, then you can feed in the Australian characteristic, whereby Australia was a landmass that has unique species that you're not found anywhere else on the planet. So if you was to put these individual species on landmasses that were so far apart that going from one to the other in a boat wouldn't have been realistic, then yes, they could have evolved roughly at the same pace, but independent of each other.
Yeah.
Until their technology reached a point where they could interact with each other, but by then evolution had already started its track.
Right. You know, that's another thing we don't know about this world, Zindus, at least I don't think we do, is we don't know how large it was. Because...
We just know it was Class M.
Right, we know it was Class M. And now I think the fact that it's Class M does restrict how large it can be and still have the type of environment that we would call Class M. But Earth is a pretty small planet, so you can actually go a good bit larger than Earth. I should know this actually because I read a lot about this stuff, but I want to say you could at least double the size of Earth and still have an environment that's what we would classify as class M.
Yeah, the Planet Hunters found one in the Goldilocks zone beginning of the year. I think Giselle, I can't think of the number. I think it was Giselle something, and it was literally twice the size of Earth.
Right, that might be what I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah, but so it was in the Goldilocks zone.
Yeah, so if you think of a planet that's twice the size of Earth, think about historically how long it took us to develop the technology to be able to traverse the oceans and how long that took even once we were able to traverse the oceans. And if you think about a planet that's twice the size of Earth, you really could have species that could evolve in their own little niches on this planet and never come in contact with anyone else for hundreds or thousands of years. I think it would be possible.
The only reason humans spread out is because they had all the land bridges.
Yeah.
That's the only reason we could spread out so quickly. But if you take some of the ice-like communities like Australia, where obviously humans evolved to, and then as the ocean rose, Australia got cut off, and you take the Aborigines, they have evolved slightly different to other humanoids.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you factor in, like we said earlier, the subtle differences between humans, you know, like Western Europeans have white skin because they don't need the protection from the sun. So whereas you go down to the southern areas, then there's darker skin, hair color changes, you know, and that's just one species.
Yeah.
You know, and now you do that on a planetary scale with lots of different species, then that just magnifies it.
Right. What I find interesting too, though, is that so on Earth, we are, no matter where people are, like we all have, at least we think we all have a single origin. You know, I have read some cases where they think there might be two origins, but I tend to think there's one single origin. And then we spread. Now, of course, if we talk about the Neanderthals, which is actually important for this discussion, and you mentioned earlier the various different hominid species that were on Earth at one point in time, there could have been some different origins. But for Homo sapiens, sapiens as we are, then, yeah, a single origin, where what we're talking about here on Zendis would be, like, I think, truly independent origins. Well, it would have to be, because we're talking about primates, we're talking about arboreals, which those two, I don't know, maybe there could be some, like I said, interbreeding at some point. But the insectoids would have to be completely independent, the reptilians completely independent, the aquatics completely independent as well. Now, the avians are interesting because we know here on Earth now that the birds that we have today are descendants of dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So there could be some connection between the reptilian origin and the avian origin within the Zendi.
Yeah. And they, even taking the aquatic scene, they would have no reason to interact with land-based creatures.
And no desire, so even though, I would assume.
Yeah, or the desire, yeah. Because, you know, why would they need to? But it's also interesting that they all have one common feature, though, which is this vent in the cheek.
Yeah.
So that's obviously a characteristic of the planet itself, much like humans now have an appendix that we don't need.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting, why would you need a vent in your cheek?
Right, yeah. So there is some, it served some purpose at some point in the history of the planet, right, for the environment. Because that's the other thing, is that they all had to evolve within the same environment. Maybe some variations in temperature, some variations in other conditions of the land, of course, the ocean. But ultimately, they evolved in the same environment on this one planet. You know, I was thinking about the whole species thing also, and what would aliens think about us? Because I was actually reading somewhere, some fans were discussing the Zendi, and it was on some site, and they were talking about, are the Zendi one species or are they six species? And within Enterprise, they're kind of presented like the Zendi are one species because they all come from this one world. But then they talk about six different Zendi. And I was wondering what, like, what would aliens think about us? Because, you know, we ourselves, we share, you know, 96 to 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees, but we don't consider ourselves to be the same as chimpanzees. And then just amongst ourselves as humans, about, it's like 0.5% of our DNA may vary from, you know, person to person, which is kind of a lot. If you think, if it's between a chimpanzee and a human, 98% and 100%, and then you've got 0.5% variation within humans, that's kind of a lot. And even with cats, like humans and cats, our genes are 90% homologous, and we certainly don't see ourselves in any way the same as cats. But that's a lot of similarity in DNA, obviously, because we both evolved on this same planet right here. So it did make me wonder, like, if aliens were viewing life on Earth, especially if, like, let's say some aliens knew how to communicate with dolphins, and it turns out that dolphins are just as intelligent as they are in Douglas Adams's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy. And aliens could communicate with them. Would they see humans and dolphins as being essentially the same? Because we both come from Earth and we're both intelligent.
Well, you could factor that forward to, say, a million years from now when humans have ceased to exist.
Yeah.
And aliens land on Earth and they find right. DNA samples.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Would they then view everything as a common species?
Yeah,
who knows? Because it's DNA characteristics that are shared.
Right. So my assumption would be any aliens that are technologically advanced enough to come to Earth and find that would have a very sophisticated classification system, and they would break everything down kind of the way we do right now when we look at our DNA records, fossil records, and such. But just for the sake of just for a discussion here, because of the way that we view the Zindi, it does make you wonder, right? How would you group those things?
Yeah, I mean, a common theme that humans share is language. We all speak using the same right. vocal cords, the same voice box. We use different words,
mm-hmm.
but we all use the same tools. So obviously, the insectoids wouldn't use the same tools as the reptilians, but they all evolved language.
Right. In fact, the primates, the reptilians, and the arboreals all use the same language. And then the aquatics and the insectoids can understand that language, but they can't speak it because they're not able to produce the language.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's the other thing when the insectoids talk that they can understand it, but the universal translator can't.
Yeah. Language is an interesting thing, too, when you talk about evolution and like a geographic isolation, because, you know, there are so many languages here on Earth, very, very vibrant languages even today. Of course, there are many, many dead languages, but if you look at European languages, they're for the most part very similar because they have very common roots, very common ancestors, and they're within the same families. You know, I don't know if you feel this way, Colin, but for me, like, I've had a lot of friends who speak German and that I actually lived with in university, and I've always found German to be a language where if I don't actually listen to the words, if I just let it wash over me, the cadence is so similar to English because obviously the two languages are so closely related to one another, but it's just, it's like so close. But then you take Japanese here, we're like literally on an island by ourselves. I mean, Japanese is... it's a Japonic language. There's like, it's a mystery as to how this language developed and what it's related to. Just as the island is isolated.
Like it.
It's like one of the very few languages in the world that really seems to not be related to much of anything. Even though we took a writing system from China, the actual spoken language is different. But yet you've got things like Korean and Turkish, which are related to each other as they spread across the planet as people migrate. But so the language evolution is interesting to me as well, and I'm glad that Enterprise played up on that.
Yeah, and there's only a few languages that we go through in Star Trek in general, mm-hmm. where the universal translator just can't cope.
Right.
You know, Darmok is one of them because they're speaking metaphors. It understood the word, but it can't understand the sentence structure.
Mm-hmm.
Insectoid is also one of the very few languages that the Universal Translator can't translate. We had Darmok, where they're speaking metaphors, so it can understand the words, but it can't understand the sentence structure. And when you go to Voyager, you've got the Voth, who also speak in cliques.
And don't forget TNG, you have the Jurata, who are also insects. And Picard has to learn that really complicated thing that he has to say to them because he has to... I don't know, was it the case with the Jurata that the Universal Translator just wouldn't work, or they would just be really insulted? Because the Jurata get insulted really easily. They would be insulted if you didn't actually do it yourself.
I think it was the tone.
Yeah.
It was the Universal Translator wouldn't get the tone. So it had to be done by a living thing, shall we say.
Poor Picard, he had to do that insect tone. He had to wear that wig in Insurrection. But he still didn't have it as bad as Archer, because Archer had to braid his hair and chainsaw a tree.
That is another weird moment from Enterprise, whereby because Porthos did what dogs do on a tree, and you therefore have to cut another tree down to apologize for the other tree getting wet.
That's right.
Which was very, very bizarre. Very, very bizarre.
It is really bizarre.
Although, you know, fair play to Porthos, you know, Strange New World, first thing he did was run out the shutter pop straight for a tree.
Well, he's a dog. So, what do you think he's going to do?
Yeah, exactly. An architect into a planet that's got loads of trees, and then dogs do what dogs do.
Well, plus, it's a new planet, and he runs over there, and he sniffs it, and he says, I don't know that dog that was here before me, so obviously he's going to mark it.
Yeah.
I mean,
and in Strange New World, he was literally the only dog.
Right.
So he had a lot of trees to get through.
Which makes me wonder if the rock people came out to sniff. No, wait a minute. Those were all imagined.
Yeah. maybe it was all the ammonia from Porthos doing all the trees that made him see things.
Oh, it could be. That's what was causing the hallucinations, right? Well, back to the Zindi here. You mentioned the Voth, and the Voth is interesting in the context of this discussion as well, because the Voth, and for those who don't know who the Voth are, they are sentient dinosaurs who evolved on Earth, who left Earth and made it to the Delta Quadrant, and then Voyager encounters them. And I know it sounds kind of dumb, but it's actually a really good episode. But the Voth evolved on Earth, and humans evolved on Earth. So this is a case where, would you consider the Voth and humans the same species? Because that's actually exactly analogous to what we're talking about with the Zindi.
You would, you would class them both as Earthlings.
Yeah.
So, like, we class all these races, like the six flavors, we class all the six flavors as Zindi. So, yeah, you would class the Voth and humans as Earthlings, because it's your country, my parents are Irish, so characteristically and genetically, I could say I'm Irish. But because I live in England, and I've lived there since I was like 1 year old, I class myself as English. So then you're doing that. So although for want of a better word, the Irish species living in England, you're still Earthlings. So the Voth, although they live on spaceships the size of small planets, their origins would be Earth. So they would be classed as Earthlings.
So you could say, my parents are humans, but I've lived on the Voth homeworld since I was one, so I see myself as Voth?
Yeah. It's like you class yourself as where you are. It's like people who emigrate.
No, it's true.
You want to integrate with the society that you emigrate into, and then become, American, or, if you're one of them people who go up north and become Canadian. Don't know why, but if you did that, or you, like you've gone to Japan, if I went to Australia, you know, then you either absorb that culture and become what that culture is, or you cling to your old culture.
Yeah.
And forevermore be an Englishman.
Well, it's completely true. You know, I mean, I am American. I was born in the US and I grew up there, but I, you know, really see myself more as Japanese at this point because I've been here so long and my whole life is here and that's what I identify with. So yeah, most definitely. So the Voth were interesting that there was a precedent for this in Star Trek, even before we got to the Zindi arc.
Yeah, because that was intelligent, advanced reptiles, basically.
Yeah. So I guess what we're coming to here is that we think that the possibility of these six species evolving on a single world is legitimate. At least theoretically. Now, again, biologically, I don't know. I actually have to ask Athena about this sometime and well, see.
If you take us, then when Homo sapiens moved into Northern Europe, Neanderthals were there. So if we hadn't moved into Northern Europe, Neanderthals would have carried on, and then there would have been two humanoid species on Earth. And if we didn't interact for a few thousand years, we would have been more or less the same level technology, perhaps. You know, if the comet hadn't hit in South America, would the dinosaurs have turned out to be the reptilians? So there is precedence there.
Yeah. Which is sort of the progression of distant origin on Voyager, right? That's what with enough time, the dinosaurs would have evolved that way. And, you know, I mean, I can certainly see if you doubled the size of the Earth, so that we could have never come in contact with the Neanderthals, then yeah, you know, maybe I think it's very, very legitimate that you would see that. And given enough time, I think you could see dolphins being like aquatics. I don't know who would turn into the insectoids, but at least I could see two humanoid species and an aquatic species on Earth.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And the aquatics.
You know, Robert J. Sawyer wrote an interesting book series where the Neanderthals became the dominant species. There's a book called Hominids. Oh. Hominids is the first book. And then he wrote a book called Humans, which tells the story from the flip side. And then he wrote a book called Hybrids, which is where they come together. But it was like it's like alternate universes, basically, where in one we evolved as we did, and in the other, Neanderthal evolved as they did, and then something happens in the lab and you get a crossover thing going. But it's a pretty interesting story.
Oh, we'll have to look that up. I like that. That sounds like Philip K. Dick when he writes alternative universes. And
Yeah. And I guess the other question of, do you think if here on Earth we evolved, Neanderthal evolved, and we're far enough apart that for thousands of years we can't come in contact because the planet is so large, but eventually we're going to develop technology that allows us to traverse the planet and we're going to come in contact, which is what happened with the Zindi here. Would we be able to coexist peacefully? And do you buy the idea that the Zindi coexisted long enough to reach the point where they could escape their planet when they themselves destroyed it in a war?
Homo sapiens quite happily kill Homo sapiens.
Yeah.
And have done for thousands of years. I actually had this discussion the other day with someone. You take the Roman Empire, 2,000 years ago, people were paying to go to the Colosseum to watch people beat each other up.
Right.
2,000 years later, people pay to watch cage fighters beat each other up.
Yeah.
The only difference between us and them is we've got technology. The basic human traits and instincts are exactly the same.
Yeah.
So I think if we had come into contact with Neanderthals, there probably would have been a period of coexistence, but inevitably it would have been one of us needs to be the dominant species.
Yeah.
It's not to say that we would have wiped them out, but I think we would have subjugated them.
Yeah, that's the thing. And that's the thing with the Zindi, is that I feel like the natural progression would be that ultimately there would have to be one dominant species. And now you could say that's what the Zindi Civil War was about, you know, that each species wanted to be the dominant species. But again, what I keep coming back to is the fact that they had to coexist for so long before they reached that century-long civil war. And that's the part that I just have trouble with, that with
yeah,
that would have been possible.
You just take England. It's a little island off the coast of Europe. And for thousands of years, people have been fighting to control this little island. You know, the Romans conquered it, the Normans conquered it, the Saxons conquered it, the Vikings had a go at it.
The Beatles, you know, conquered it.
The Beatles conquered it, yeah.
Yeah.
And all the damage that did. and that's just one little island. And all them people have been trying to conquer it for thousands of years.
Yeah.
So this is the problem with this. And to have a faction like the Insectoids and the Reptilians, which are definitely warmongers, I can't see them finding the Arboreals with their laid-back approach and thinking, yeah, let's be friends.
Right. They would just go...
That wouldn't have happened.
They would just slaughter them, I think.
Yeah. They'd just roll over them.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. All right. Well, what are your final thoughts on the Zindi as far as what we've talked about here and then what they gave to Enterprise and gave to Star Trek?
I think the concept of the Zindi, what Brannon Braggar and Berman came up with, was a brilliant concept. Let's throw the rule book out the window and say, what happened if XYZ happened?
Right, yeah.
And I think that was a brilliant leap to make, especially given, like, you know, most of us know that most humanoid races in Star Trek are down to the Preservers.
Yeah.
So we know that. And I think that was a brilliant leap.
Yeah.
What they gave to Enterprise was a different way of looking at things. And it also gave us a chance to see Archer in a completely different light. Which, when you're watching season 4, you've got to reflect on what he's done in season 3. And I think it takes the character of Archer and the crew in general, in some ways, to a completely different places.
Yeah. Which some people don't like, and some people do, because some people think that it made Archer too dark and angry. I think it made him grow up to the realities of life in the universe, personally.
Yeah. And I've had this discussion with people, and it's just like, you know, I could see Kirk doing what Archer did.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever it took to save Earth, Kirk would have done.
Well, I could see Picard doing it as well, even though he normally is very diplomatic and very measured in his approach to things. I mean, if you push him to that point, I could see that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, Sisko,
I mean, Archer, when he takes the warp drive off that ship, knowing it's going to strand him 3 years from home. But, and then later on in the series, when he actually gets contact, and he thinks, hang on, maybe we can do this without, like, you know, wiping him out. You know, like the episode The Shipments, where Reed just wants to orbital bombard him, or let's plant some charges and kill them all. But Archer's, no, let's talk.
Right.
So it's Archer's, we get to see so many sides of Archer because of the Zindi story arc.
Yeah, it rounded out his character.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I agree with you in that it doesn't all make sense, first of all. But I think that's okay. I mean, I think sometimes as fans, like, we want everything to make sense. Again, I read someone that said that Enterprise has to take place in an alternate timeline because no one ever mentioned the NX-01 in the original series or the Next Generation or anything else. And I thought, you can't really hold the writers to that. You know, you have to be able yourself as a viewer to put that stuff into context when it's created later on, because, you know, you're creating a whole franchise here. And so I don't think that everything has to make perfect sense in order for us to enjoy it or to be able to appreciate it as an SF concept. And I think that it's really interesting here, the idea, what if, like you said, what if there was a planet where every possible trajectory from, you know, insects or sloths or whatever, they all evolve sentience. What if that happened? What would it be like? And maybe they could have made sense of it if that had been the focus of the season, as opposed to the focus being on finding a weapon so that Earth isn't destroyed. And so, unfortunately, we don't get to delve into the whole concept of the Zindi as much as maybe we would like to. But it doesn't mean it's not an interesting idea. Here's one other thing I was thinking about, Colin. And tell me what you think about this. Now, season three was largely taking what happened to the U.S. and the world in the 9/11 attacks and putting it into science fiction wrappings. And one thing I see here that's interesting is that at first you think that, you know, Starfleet, humans, we're the United States in the situation, and we're going out and we're finding the people who carried out this attack, and those people are the Zindi. But on the flip side, you can also look at the Zindi as being us, because with the Zindi, you have all these different people who they have different ways of seeing the world, they have different agendas, but they come together in the face of a threat. To them, we're the threat. Earth is the threat, because the sphere builders have told them that Earth is going to destroy their world. And I kind of see the five species of Zindi who are still alive as being like the United States and England and, you know, Russia, or everyone who came together to say, you know, this attack was wrong, and the world cannot stand for something like this. So whether, you know, not everyone helped out militarily, but everyone felt sympathetic. And you can almost see the Zindi as being us in that situation, where it is the diversity of the world coming together against a threat. And I don't know if that's what Brandon and Rick were going for in some of the writing, but it is one way that you can read the Zindi.
It's interesting that you make that point, because there's six species of the Zindi, and the UN Security Council has six permanent members.
Yeah. So that's, you know, if you want to like really, really try to read into the season, if you want to read the 9/11 analogies in there, I do think that is one way to go. One possible.
Definitely, yeah.
One possible way.
And it was also when the beam attacked Earth, it cut through Florida. So yeah, that's a good analogy, yeah.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, actually, Colin, about the Zindi and the possible parallels there, and of course, you know, how it corresponds to evolution here on Earth and such. But we've been talking about all kinds of other stuff on the network this week as well. So for everyone listening, here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Rewriting TOS Season 1 with Mark Cushman.
This is a show that was an excellent show. Let's face it, it was, I think, one of the best shows ever made. Certainly the best show at that time. I think the best written show, because Gene Roddenberry was so determined that every episode would have a strong theme and make a statement.
Earl Grey.
TNG Season 8.
Or no, this is it. The Traveler is a Q, and so the Traveler shows up with Wesley, Q shows up and's like, Q? What are you doing here?
I go by T now.
The Orb.
Sisko as captain versus commander.
I mean, with the war and everything going on, there's a part of him that's really hardened. But at the same time, yeah, when it comes to the people that are around him, whether it's Cassidy, which, you know, the idea that he would forgive Cassidy, I wouldn't see him doing that in the first few seasons.
The Ready Room.
The Game.
But the ending of the episode is Data flashing a flashlight, and I think that's kind of a lame ending. I just wanted to bring
you. You wanted to say the end of the episode was Data flashing people on the bridge.
I know. That's also part of Daniel's fanfic number 58.
To the journey!
The 37's commentary.
I had a dream the other day where I met Robert Beltran in a Macy's, and I like totally geek out on him, but I try to say like, oh no, I totally have also know you from your Hispanic and Native American plays, and like I was trying to like BS my way through saying I only know you from Star Trek Voyager.
Did it work?
I woke up. Warp 5.
Horror on Enterprise.
It's not just losing control of yourself, it's the fact that zombies, even zombie Vulcans, cannot be reasoned with.
Some would say that normal Vulcans can't be reasoned with, Kate.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Harlan Ellison Recap.
Well, I also think it's entirely possible that Harlan Ellison has encountered a lot of people ripping off his stuff because he's actually a prophet. And he just saw the future and thought, that's a good idea for an Outer Limits episode.
Literary Treks.
Q and Trelane Comics.
Kirk is actually doing the hands thing that he does, you know, where he's trying to make a point with his hands.
Yeah, that's right.
He's actually doing it in the comic. It's fantastic. It feels just like Kirk.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in a variety of places, including iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can download or stream from the website. All right, Colin, we had some feedback since the last time Kate and I recorded a show here, and I'll be interested to get your thoughts on the feedback here real quick. This is from Daniel Noah in California. And Daniel wrote in following probably the show we did where we talked about the temporal Cold War. And Daniel says, so I loved your show and I started watching Enterprise when it first aired in 2001 when I was 15. And that certainly makes me feel old, Colin. But I have to say. Right?
Is that puppy?
But Daniel says, having been a TOS fan and a movie fan, not so much other modern Trek, Enterprise was a breath of fresh air to me for a number of reasons. And that's something I hear from a lot of people, actually, that there are a lot of Enterprise fans who aren't really into the other Star Trek series.
Yeah, it's they are kind of unique.
Yeah, they are. But interestingly here, Daniel said that you guys seem really hard on the third and fourth seasons, and Manny Coto, who Brandon Braga has repeatedly praised. He says, I'm specifically writing about the temporal Cold War. I don't know, Daniel, I'm not sure if you've listened to all the shows of Warp 5, and if you have, and we came across that way, I don't think that's really the case of our feeling. Now it is true. I think that both Kate and I like season 1 and 2 a little bit better than we like season 3 and 4. But the position that I'm coming from anyway, in that is that I'm just looking at it as television writing. I'm not looking at it as much as a TOS prequel. If you look at it as a TOS prequel, then yeah, I mean, season 4 and what Manny Coto did is the best work in terms of leading us towards the original series. So that was kind of interesting. But Colin, about the Temporal Cold War, Daniel said the Temporal Cold War was very unpopular when Enterprise aired. As much as I enjoyed it, but it barely plays into season 2, and after season 1 had very little interest. But regarding the sphere builders, you seem to have forgotten The Expanse, where Future Guy tells Archer that the Zindi have guiders from the future. So the sphere builders are set up from jump. They are not an afterthought. So here, Daniel is talking about, Colin, when we said that we felt like the sphere builders were a bit of an afterthought, and my feeling on it was that I didn't really mean that the sphere builders, in terms of they exist, are completely an afterthought. I just felt that the way that they were worked into the story, the way that they themselves, when we actually get to see them, were worked into the story, felt like it came too late in the season. And so it didn't have the impact on me that I think it needed to have. What do you think about that?
Well, the thing with Future Guy is Berman himself admitted that they made a mistake with Future Guy, which is why they got rid of him. In regards to the sphere builders, I presume he's alluding to the X-Spies when they pull the pod onto the ship and open it up, and there's a Zindi inside.
That's one that we talked about, yeah. Yeah.
Although at the time, obviously, we didn't know it was Zindi.
Yeah.
But Brannan, Ann, and Berman have actually said themselves that in that episode, they weren't sure what they was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if the people writing the series weren't sure what they were going to do, then you can't exactly expect the fans to have a leap when there's nowhere to leap to.
Yeah.
So, but I don't think you and Kate have been particularly hard, to be honest.
I don't think so. And I mean, honestly, I'm kind of a defender of season three now. Now, I didn't like season three when it came on television and I watched it in first run. I mean, I didn't hate it or anything, but it wasn't my... It felt weird. It didn't feel like Star Trek to me as much because... Well, for one thing, it felt like a ratings gimmick at the time because you knew that the series was in trouble and then they came up with this and it felt like that. But recently when I did one of my rewatches of Enterprise, I watched I watched the whole series, all four seasons, over the course of like 3 weeks or less. It was really quick. And so I watched season three over the course of a few days, maybe like 4 days or something like that. And season three actually works quite well if you watch it the way that most of us watch television, or a lot of us watch television these days, with kind of binge watching, where we'll watch like 3 or 4 episodes of something in a day. It works quite well. I think it's a nice exercise in creativity, and it works within itself. And as for season four, Daniel says this is also why season four is so important. This is when they actually start doing historic stuff, which, yes, is absolutely true. That's when, of course, they brought Judith and Gar in to help write. And, and you know, they've written some of the absolute best Star Trek novels. And so they were excellent, along with Manny Coto and everyone else who was working on the series there to lead us into TOS. But Daniel says, this is why the temporal stuff had to finish. Cody's sentiment was that our characters needed to start doing stuff in their own time because of who they are, not because of Daniel's. He had to actually start founding the Federation. Episodes like Babel 1 set up the future while also being awesome stories. The Borderland trilogy, while giving us the Orions, also gives us more insight into Earth culture and politics than anything in season 1. And yeah, absolutely, I agree with you, Daniel. That's why with season 1, I'm looking at it as television writing, not as a prequel, because you're absolutely right that season 4 gives us far more.
But Manny Coto didn't suddenly appear. Manny Coto was there behind the scenes.
But in season 4, Manny was able, he had control at that point. You know, he could say, this is the direction
he was a showrunner,
So that's the thing there. So I think Daniel, you make some really great points. I think maybe we're coming across a little bit differently than we feel if you feel like we're hard on season 3 and 4. I've said before that I feel like Enterprise is 3 different shows. There's season 1 and 2, that's one show. Season 3 is another show, and season 4 is yet another show.
Yeah. And Manny Coto himself actually said that there was a plan to do another series arc in season 4, but what they went with instead was the 2 and 3 episode story arcs.
Which I love. I love the way they did season 4.
Yeah. So, and I mean, the fact that, like, you know, you got to remember, Daniel, that a lot of time, how many times Spock wiped Kirk's memory. So Kirk might have come into contact with loads of people and just doesn't remember.
Yeah, he just doesn't remember.
You know.
That's right.
Because, I mean, when Kirk fell in love, Spock wiped his memory.
That's right.
A lot of people would like that gift.
Right. But I like the 3-story arcs very much. You know, of course, DS9 is my favorite series. I love the serialization, and I like that Enterprise had an element of that serialization in it, even outside of season 3. But I really like those 3-story arcs that they do. I think it's a nice way of telling a story.
The biggest criticism I've heard from Trek News and Views and from other podcasts that I've done is the biggest criticism people have with season 3 is... the Zindi had such a massive effect on Earth.
Yeah, and there's no history of it. Yeah,
there's no history of them.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, I think you have to kind of figure out for yourself how you work that into the timeline. But at the same time, I think you have to give the writers the freedom to do stuff like that, just because...
Oh, totally. I mean, I have no problem with the Romulans popping up.
Yeah.
in Enterprise and already having cloaking technology.
Right.
I have no problem with that because, you know, the United States now has planes that can fly across the planet that no one can see.
Right.
So
it's only the Ferengi who we have a problem with popping up on Enterprise, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, little green man.
So. All right. Well, but Daniel, thanks so much for your message. We really appreciate the feedback. And for everyone else, if you'd like to share your thoughts with us, you can do that by going to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Just choose Warp 5. Well, choose to send to a show and then choose Warp 5, and that'll come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website. You can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the show and about Enterprise. And then in social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek under username trekfm. Now, Colin, when you're not up there in the abandoned caves searching for some bottles of Avian brandy for yourself, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at colmh01.
Excellent. Very good. And of course, launching very soon is your new show here on the network, Melodic Treks, where you'll be talking about the music of Star Trek.
Yes. We'll be delving into the, much like this show, we'll be delving into the minutiae of the music. How the actual individual music came into being, and we'll also be exploring some of the scores, what other people like about music. Anything music based to do with Star Trek, basically.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun show. And as some listeners know, I'm actually a musician and played professionally for a long time, and so I'm really looking forward to that show and hoping maybe I'll get to sit in with you from time to time.
Yeah, I found out. The TNG theme tune played on a trombone.
So, maybe I'll do that on one of the shows. Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that, and I hope everyone else is as well. Not the trombone part, but the show itself that you're going to be doing. So if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And I do write a little bit about Star Trek over there, as well as I'm doing rewatches and such. And elsewhere on the network, you can find me on quite a few shows. I do two shows with Matthew Rushing. The first one is Literary Treks, where we talk about Star Trek books and comics, and we interview authors as well. And Matthew and I also do The Orb together, where we talk exclusively about Deep Space Nine, just like we talk about Enterprise here on Warp 5. And you'll also find me on my interview show, Matterstream, where I talk to scientists and writers and actors and creatives and all sorts of people about topics loosely associated with Star Trek. And then I'm on the big show, The Ready Room, every week, where I'm joined by hosts from all across the network and special guests from around the world of Star Trek as we talk about Star Trek news and also about all five live-action Star Trek series. So check out all of those shows if you have a chance. Also, Colin, before we let everyone go, we'd like to ask you to please support our sponsor for this week's show. Your support of our sponsor is very important for helping us bring Warp 5 to you every week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read, but never thought you'd have time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks. They have over 150,000 titles to choose from on the site right now, and they add new books every week. And Colin, I've been a member of Audible for 14 years. Can you believe that?
No. I do use Audible, but not for 14 years.
Yeah, 14 years. It used to get me through my commutes back in the day here in Tokyo. I used to commute 4.5 hours round trip every day to go to work. And Audible was really important. This was before iPods even. I had like the little creative digital audio player.
Oh, you had the creative player.
Yeah, I had that. Yeah, and so I
had one of those.
I had a few things. I had that. I had a pocket PC as well. The old ran some version of Windows, and you could put stuff on there. But yeah, Audible really, really helped me keep my sanity back in the day, and I still use them even to this day. They have just lots of classics on there. They have current bestsellers. They have lots of Star Trek books. I mentioned Judith and Gar when we were talking a minute ago. They have Prime Directive and a Federation on there. Federation is one of Judith and Garfield Reeve Stevens' best books.
If people listen to your recent Matter stream, they can find out that Armin Shimerman is on Audible.
He is, yes, narrating a couple of books there, a couple of the DS9 books. So, check it out and help us keep the show coming to you. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice. So you can choose any Star Trek book or even non-Star Trek book that you like just for trying Audible. And to get that offer, just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm to get that offer. And we really thank Audible for supporting Warp 5 and the network. Also, we want to give a shout out to Andrew Allen and his album Smooth Federation. That's where the smooth jazz version of Where My Heart Will Take Me that we use here on Warp 5 comes from. Colin, do you like the smooth jazz version better than the one on the show?
I do actually like it, yeah. I do actually like it.
I think, you know, I hear people complain all the time about the theme of the show on the television show. I don't think anyone's going to complain about what Andrew has done here because it's a really nice rendition.
And much, much better than Russell Watson pretending to be Rod Stewart.
Right. Yeah, I don't have a problem with the theme myself, but I know it grates on a lot of fans. But you can get Andrew's version of Where My Heart Will Take Me, plus 9 other jazz renditions of music from across Star Trek by picking up the album in iTunes or on Amazon. Again, that's Smooth Federation. Go check that out. I promise you're going to love that album. And lastly, there's one more way you can directly help us keep Warp 5 coming to you each week, and that is by getting some aliens. We have original alien illustrations by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on the website. And you can mix and match how you want it. We have them as badges, and we have them as art prints. And you can decide what you want. We have different contribution levels for you to choose from as well. And your donations help us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the show to you each week. And you'll find them all at trek.fm/donate. And we really thank you for helping us keep the network going. All right, Colin. Well, this is usually Kate's little thing here at the end, but I'll do it this week. I'll just say that I hope you'll join me once again in the Decon Chamber, along with the listeners in the future.
As long as I don't get Paul Fuss rubbing the cream on.
Well, he's the dog at the end of the line, Colin.
So. Yeah, that's what I mean. That'd be my luck.
So, but I hope you'll join me again, and I hope everyone listening will also join us again for another episode of Warp 5.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.